Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that explores the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson, and we have a special treat for our listeners. Today, April 30th, is the last day of the month that is traditionally called the Month of Poetry. So here at KHOI, we thought instead of ending the month with a bang, or worse, a whimper, we would go end it with a slam. That's right, a poetry slam. Here in the studio, we have someone who has organized the Poetry Slam in Ames over the years and then passed that baton off to other people, Jim Kopik, who got the Ames Poetry Slam going more than a decade ago. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Greta.
And we will be hearing from you, Jim, as a poet, as well as an organizer of the slam, and as a historian of slams. I understand you wrote your dissertation on this subject.
My first master's thesis was on slam, and just about everything I've done since has also been somehow related.
Great. And we have three other poets in the studio, Javier Cavazos, Jennifer L. Knox, and Claire Kruzel. These three are stars of the Ames scene, and are well-known nationally as well, with books in print. They will be sharing their spoken word throughout the course of the hour. So let's get started right away with a poem. Javier Cavazos, I am told, traveled with Allen Ginsberg, who is the godfather of the spoken word tradition. And in 1995, Javier was the champion of the New Yorican Poetry Slam. So why don't we start with you?
Thanks, Greta. Thanks for having us here. This is really special to be part of this program and to be with this fine assortment of poets, all my friends. So it's really an honor. All right, so I'm going to start by reading a poem about George Washington Carver. So when I got to Ames, Iowa, I was fascinated that George Washington Carver was alumni here at Iowa State University. And I wanted to write, it's funny that it's on this program that I'm reading it, but I wanted to write poetry that was as opposition to slam aesthetic as there was. So basically poetry with exceptional restraint and very sparse delivery on the page. So what I have is kind of the work of that. And so it's going to be published in a manuscript by Ice Cube Press in April of 2015. So please keep an eye out for that. And I'll be reading from it next year here in Ames, Iowa as well once the book launches. So this one is looking at a photograph of George Washington Carver when he's at Tuskegee University. And it's just from that experience. It's called Carver's National Lampoon Laboratory. Oh, those white folks sure are funny, ha ha. Funny like a cracked nut in a split opened shell. Postured and more brittle than a dried thistle in a closed Bible book. Starch chemistry, the way they marvel at me, like a colored comic. Red and blue on my lip. Hem and haw at my peas in a pod. Salted wounds heal quick with reaction and blue ribbons on the wall. A photograph plays big band classic in the lab. Like a dog, I smile and scratch two glass beakers in my earth hands. So much electricity and one wild nut coloring this whole tiny room. So that's Carver's National Lampoon Laboratory, which is a little meditation at maybe what his lab experience might be like. And then I'll end on a poem that's written sort of as a persona poem from the voice of the boll weevil, which of course the boll weevil is what Carver predicted that was coming and was going to really deplete the southern crops. And so he came up with alternative crops or alternative ways to yield the most nutrient sort of peanut and goobers and yams as well. So this is called Boll Weevil. One, King Cotton was eaten by me. was brought to his knee by tiny me. Now, in evening, I swing from tree to weed to bankrupt commerce billfold. Funny, aren't I, blackening these southern fields, this emptied space, this white land. And two, if not for me, no need for George Washington Carver, no alternative crop to cotton, no peanut to crack open, no shell to crunch.
That was Javier Cavazos reading from a forthcoming manuscript, Diamond Grove Slave Tree. And that was wonderful, Javier. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are reading poems today. It is the last day of Poetry Month, and we have four poets, in the room here with us. And Jim Kopic, you are kind of a historian of the slam tradition. And will you tell us what it means that Javier was a New Yorican champion back in 1995?
New Yorican Grand Slam champion, if I remember right.
Right.
It is a huge honor to be Hav. And you have won that. First, thank you for having our whole little motley band of poets here. It's exciting to see poetry culture in Ames anywhere, but especially on KHOI. Quick thumbnail of how slam grew, because that's important for understanding the New Yorican. For the last 400 years or so, people have been predicting constantly that poetry is about to die tomorrow. Right, and sometimes it really does look like that, because it ebbs and it flows and it waxes and it wanes. One of those times was the mid-1980s. In Chicago, a construction worker named Mark Smith was running an open mic for poetry that was dying. And he racked his brains trying to think, how can I get an audience in? How can I get people through the doors? How can I get this thing started? Mark came up with the idea, I know, I'll make a game show format. And I'll bring people in the doors to play the games. So from that moment forward, that was at the Get Me High Lounge in the mid-1980s in Chicago, we started playing this poetry game that grew from Chicago to Boston to the West Coast to all over the country in just a few years. It's still an open mic. People walk in off the street, they sign up for the Poetry Slam, but they compete. There are judges that use Olympic scorecards. There are prizes. Usually the prizes are silly, but it's just enough gimmick to get people excited. So that's what Poetry Slam is. What the New Yorican did for Slam was, as it was growing in those first few crucial years, right? Because Slam is a great idea, but people have great ideas all the time, and they fizzle and they die and whatever. But Slam kept growing and growing, and it was because of some of these key venues early on, the Cantab Lounge in Boston, all these other spots. The New Yorican was one of them that started to develop a form that worked in this game, a form where the performer connected to the audience and the audience connected back to the performer, and it was made to be live and it was made to be done from the stage, not from the page. And a style started building there in the early 90s in the New Yorican, and Hav was one of the pioneers of this style. There was another guy who has his own school of people following him, Saul Williams, who's probably the most famous voice to come out of the New Yorican. There were lots of other early pioneers. If you wanted to be in spoken word poetry in the 90s, New York was a great place to do it. And the New Yorican was leading the charge. We still slam 20 years later with influence from where Hav was in the 90s. So he, to have won the honor he won, to be the Grand Slam champion, means he was among the best of the best at one of the most crucial times in the development of the slam movement. And I'm excited just to share a radio studio with him today.
Well, me too.
Thanks, Jim.
And Javier, if you would step up to the microphone. I understand that you have recently won another award. Can you explain
sure.
what that
is? It's called the Poetry Society of America Chapbook Fellowship. So every year they promote four new emerging writers, so poets who haven't published a first book of poetry, and they award two national Chapbook Fellows and two New York City Chapbook Fellows. And then the award comes with a chapbook, which launches in New York City at a reading that we did last April, or no, just this month. It's still April. It's still April. Mm-hmm. It seemed like it's been a long time already. But
long.
Yeah, it was just at the beginning of this month, and so it's a real honor. It comes with an introduction by the judge. My judge was a poet named Thomas Sayers Ellis, so it was really special because he's one of my favorite poets. And so it was a real honor to be selected by him. And, yeah, and so the chapbook's available. It's called Barbarian at the Gate. And it's available from my publisher, the Poetry Society of America. And you can just go online and you can order one if you'd like. It's quite different than what I do in Carver, the Diamond Grove Slave Trade manuscript. But I believe it's my most powerful work. It's very dynamic and very slamish in aesthetic.
Right.
So
I told everyone today that we had to follow FCC guidelines, and therefore that limited some of the scope of the slam nature.
Drastically.
Yeah. I was like, I can't bring that book here.
So,
not all slam is built on swear words, just to be clear.
Mine is.
Yeah, Jennifer's are.
So we'll link to that website for the Poetry Society of America. Jim, I understand you were also in New York at this time when Hav was doing his thing.
I was, but I was nowhere near as brave as people like Hav. Back then, I was in the poetry audience. It was still a long time before I could become a poet myself and take the stage like these guys were. So I came and I watched and I saw some of the most amazing poetry that is... It went so deep. It's part of my core identity today.
Wow. Do you have something to share?
Yeah, I did bring some poems. Like Hav, I sort of flip back and forth between the spoken word world and the literary world. This one is from my first book, which is the slammiest of my books. But it's one of the quieter of the slam poems. It's called 52, which the numerologists in your radio audience can figure out on their own. Because the Tao of me is you. Because unconscious is our natural state, because we wake for such a short time, so much of it sleeping, eating, defecating, breathing, because we spend so much of it contemplating death. Because something is better than nothing. Because nothing is better than some things. Because loving is better than leaving. I choose this life. This is a love poem. Because there are some things greater than you, but I don't know them. Because every breath before you was wasted, and every breath since is still in my lungs. Because my lungs are still, because my breath is still, because I still breathe for you, because I see you in pieces. Because two eyes are better than none, because each piece is a mystery, because there is no peace in our history, because I see only the whole. I choose this life, because I no longer ache with the moon, because the moon aches alone, because the moon is so cliche in a love poem. Because I'd lay down my life before I lay down my pen, because I bleed now in color, because I save my sweat for our bed, because I choose this life, because you and I are sperm and egg, because the whole is greater than the sum of its pieces, because love is free, because freedom is love, because I'd still love you wrinkly, because time means nothing now, because my breath is still, because I still breathe for you. This is a love poem, because I know who I am, because fortune has no flavor, because the Tao of me is you, because nothing is better than some things. I choose this life, because I'd lay down my pen before I lay down my soul, because I'd lay down my soul at your feet, because I mean so much more than sex when I say take me, because I'd lay down down my soul, because I love you in pieces, because the Tao of me is you, because there are some things greater than you, but I don't know them, because I see you in pieces, because I see you in pieces, because I see me in your pieces, because my soul is the sum of our pieces, because I lay down my soul, because this is a love poem. I choose this life because I choose this life because I choose this life because I choose you.
Right on. Yeah. Dan!
That was awesome. Well, thank you, Jim. Now, that you said that was a more slammy.
We use the word slammy because it's an open mic. You can bring any style. You can bring any length up to 3 minutes and 9 seconds. You can bring poems about anything. But most of the time, because you're on a stage in a room and there are people watching you and they're sitting out in the room, you want something a little bit bigger. And you want something that's simple enough that they can take it in one pass because they don't get to go back and reread lines and stanzas. And you want something to get the audience excited and get them cheering for you and get the judges excited and giving you good scores. So when we say slammy, what we mean is the kind of poems that help us play the game. But any poems allowed in a poetry slam.
Oh, that's cool. Okay, so, but this one had a sort of driving rhythm. There was a lot of repetition. There was some play on words, like still and that kind of thing. You find that in other poems, but...
Well, all the devices are there. And all the devices have been there as long as humans have been in community with other humans. Writing down poems in the scope of human existence is a pretty new thing, right? We've had the oral tradition and we've had poetry as a part of our lives as long as the species has existed. And so rhythm, repetition, imagery, figurative language, it's all always been there. It's all always going to be there. It just shows up differently on the stage or on the page or in religious literature or children's books or Hallmark cards or hip hop or wherever you find poetry. Same ingredients, different recipes.
Okay. You're also the MC, or one of the MCs, for the Ames Poetry Revival.
I am.
Okay, and this is a reincarnation of the Poetry Slam that you started when you got here a dozen or so years ago.
Yeah, I started maybe 12 years ago the Bohemian Poetry Slam, which was at the Boheme, which doesn't exist anymore. So a group of us who were driving from Ames to Des Moines to go to their slam, which is the longest running slam in Iowa, we decided we also wanted something in our hometown. So we started our own slam with our own people and quickly discovered that Ames is a good home for poetry. So we ran that for a few years. We took a couple years off. And then Jay Perry, who is an Ames local, who's involved in both poetry and music scenes, decided a couple years back that he wanted to regrow the slam, and he made the genius move of linking those two scenes together. So we meet every month at DG's Tap House. Can I put in a plug?
Sure.
I'm putting in a plug. The first Tuesday of the month at DG's Tap House at precisely 8 o'clock poetry time, which is sometime between 8 o'clock and when we feel like it. But around 8 o'clock, first Tuesday of every month at DG's Tap House, and we have poems for a couple of hours, and we have bands for a couple of hours, and we come together in this big spoken word oral tradition community family, and sometimes it's magic. Sometimes it's underattended. It ebbs and it flows like everything else, but it's a good scene. Jay might be on later on in the hour.
Well, he is certainly an enthusiast. Just like you said that Ames is a good place for poetry, he was raving in his messages to me about how many talented people are here. And among them, he mentioned our other two guests, Jennifer L. Knox and Claire Kreuzel.
Hi.
Hey there. Jennifer.
Yes.
Was born in Southern California, and now she taught poetry writing at Hunter College and New York University. Her poems have appeared 4 times in the Best American Poetry Series, which is quite an accomplishment. And
thanks.
Also The New Yorker, American Poetry Review, Fence, McSweeney's, and Bomb. And those are all very well-respected publications. You have 3 books of poetry, and I see that you have brought the most recent of them, The Mystery of the Hidden Driveway. And I just must describe the cover
Please
of
do.
The book.
Please do.
It looks like a Nancy Drew book. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's written in the same type font as many of those books were. And it is called The Mystery of the Hidden Driveway. There's a corgi somewhere in
There is.
In
there's
the picture.
A corgi on there.
And there's a Nancy Drew-looking character.
If you Google my name, Jennifer L. Knox, one thing that comes up is a YouTube video that I made about 5 years ago about corgis. So the artist who painted that knew I had a thing for corgis and did me a solid by putting one on my cover. So,
tell us about what you're going to read.
I'm going to read a poem out of my latest book. I went backwards into SLAM. I took 2 poetry writing classes at the University of Iowa as an undergraduate, and I knew I loved it, but then I graduated and went out into the world, and the first community of poets I found was the SLAM community in Houston, where I moved to, and I was doing teaching with Teach for America at the time, and I loved it, and I loved SLAM. This was back in 91, 92. And I went to the Nationals, and when I moved to Milwaukee, I used to be on the Milwaukee Slam team, and it taught me, it didn't just teach me how to read, it taught me how to write. And it taught me how to write succinctly and how to grab people's attention, and the lessons of Slam were innumerable. And I think even though I don't Slam anymore, I don't have the... I'm not brave enough for it anymore. I still feel that the how one speaks the poem is central to my work now. So, and now I'm going to read a poem that's not like that at all. This is called Dead Italians. In the back of my freezer... 2 different freezers in 2 different apartments. For 9 months, the time it takes to have a baby, I've carried 3 pounds of sausage. Spicy Italian sausage, homemade in Milwaukee, sausage capital of planet Earth. Carried them home on the plane last July, stowed them still fresh in the overhead bin 2 hours, and have carried them ever since from apartment to apartment, from summer to winter, and nigh on to July again. And sometimes I'd say to no one, to everyone, hey, I've got spicy Italians from Milwaukee in my freezer. But today, I thawed them out, and they'd gone bad. I could tell by the smell, so the song says. They'd probably been bad all this time. And so the allegory comes of itself. Frozen food is imagined food, and therefore lives only in the mind. To treasure, even love, that which lives only in the mind is to love nothing, till the beloved of the mind becomes flesh, steps from the mist, and suddenly you're dancing with your love, arms wrapped, torsos grooved together like tongue tip to envelope flap. You think, at last, but then you smell death. Your lips never touched, but already long dead. Now imagine a violin braying as the lover dips you dangerously low, then lower. Wouldn't that make a great opera?
We were all just about to break out in laughter right there.
Good.
That was very, very
I think
funny.
That was one thing that Slam gave me permission to do, and that was make people laugh. That you don't necessarily get that if you're writing for the page or you're writing in a workshop. It's not necessarily encouraged, but when you have a bunch of people in front of you, you might as well make the best of it.
Okay, do you have another one?
I do. My cousin, Mark Evsis, was in a Burt Reynolds tribute band called Hooper. And the guys would perform, and they would wear different colored jumpsuits. Like, one guy was Brian Keith, and one guy was Jan Michael Vincent. And, of course, since it was my cousin's band, he was Burt Reynolds. And so he was telling me about Burt and the complexities that are Burt. And he said, it's easy to be a Harrison. Well, he has a Southern accent. So he said, hey, it's easy to be a Harrison Ford fan. Because that guy's got, like, he's into woodworking, and he works for Greenpeace. I mean, who can't get behind that? That's easy. But to love Burt is to love a man who makes mistakes, colossal mistakes, every day. And I thought, wow, that's kind of like a Hindu god. Because the Hindu gods make these, they're flawed entities. And you love them, you love their mistakes. So I wrote this. It's called Burt Reynolds FAQ. Burt Reynolds is the son of six grizzly bear brothers and the holy goddess of cherry trees. He was born from his mother's nose, which ensures lifelong charisma. Before he could walk, alligators would gather to watch him wrestle other babies. He excelled at all sport, especially football, baseball, gymnastics, rugby, tennis, archery, swimming, sailing, and horseback riding. At school, Burt was not the brightest student in class, but he was the luckiest. Whenever the teacher called upon him, he would guess the answer correctly. When Burt was seven, he grew his first mustache. Wealthy older women fought for the privilege of combing it through with gold paint. He was made a general in the president's army, but on the eve he was to leave for battle, robbers clobbered his knees with a tar-covered club. Burt was crushed because his knees were crushed, but he never cried. The president's queen said, "Stay here and read me stories," because he was also the most talented storyteller in the land. So he rose to great power, which made the priests and princes jealous. After the night a murderer poured mercury into his ear as he lay sleeping, Burt became the lion who did not want to be loved. But the people would not let Burt not be loved. But neither would Burt be pinned. The match is still going. No one knows who will win. At night, Burt returns to his home on the edge of a fire pit with a lush green yard full of tigers, waiting for him to read them a story, like the old days. Burt does not believe he'll have no need for toupees in heaven. In summer, his mustache still grows unruly with Lily of the Valley.
Thank you. That was Jennifer Knox, Jennifer L. Knox, I should say.
The L stands for Samuel L. Jackson, just in case you're wondering.
Okay. Yeah. You come from that Hollywood part of the world.
I do.
Mm-hmm. So,
Hollyweird, yes.
And you moved here just last year.
I did. I moved here at the end of September. I think we're both Nevadians, aren't we?
Oh.
You and I?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I am a Nevadian.
I am a Nevadian.
Oh.
We are Nevadians.
And we are KHOI Community Radio. This is Local Talk. And we are celebrating the end of Poetry Month with a slam of sorts. We're talking about the slam in Ames, which has been going on for more than a decade in various reincarnations. Currently, it is the Ames Poetry Revival. It takes place the second Tuesday.
First Tuesday
of every month at DG's Tap House, which is coming right up.
Mm-hmm.
And we have with us Jim Kopek, who is the, actually, blah. Let's take a musical break and come back and listen to poems by Claire Creusel.
Yay.
Creusel?
Creusel.
How do I say that?
Normalize the signal and you're banging on Freon. Paleolithic eon. Put the fake goatee on and it booms as cool as sugar-free jazz. Placemat won't lap, but help you with the automat, and it's clear and clean as sugar-free jazz.
Welcome back to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. That was Soul Coughing doing a tune called Sugar Free Jazz, a request from the crowd here at our little poetry slam that we are having to celebrate the end of April, which is Poetry Month. Up at the mic, we have Claire Kreisel.
Hi.
Hi, Claire. I know Claire from yoga. She's an outstanding yoga teacher. She's from Minnesota and came down here for biochemistry.
Yes, originally.
And then her hobbies seem to have taken off, and now she's in the poetry workshop at Iowa State University. Did you have read at Ames Poetry Revival?
Yes. Regrettably, grad school is more busy than I hoped or anticipated, so I really haven't been as involved as I'd like to be this last year, but it's a great scene, great people, and I did used to read pretty regularly especially when it was getting established. So I encourage anyone with a free Tuesday to go down there. If you're not sure if it's the right Tuesday, just go anyway and it'll be good.
Well, though you have not been there, you are missed because everyone insisted that you come on and read your poetry. So
aww.
Why don't you share something with us?
Okay. Well, I'm going to read two pieces. The second one's a little bit longer, and it's being published in the upcoming Prairie Gold Anthology of the American Heartland, which was edited by three wonderful people, one of which is here with us today, Javier, however you choose. It was an editor on this, and I already heard that it's been picked up by Barnes & Noble in New York City physically. They're going to have copies there, so...
Awesome.
It's really exciting.
The title of that book is Prairie Gold.
Prairie Gold, an Anthology of the American Heartland. And the other two editors are Lance Sacknoff and Stephanie Brooke Trout, who's in my year of the program as well.
Wow.
So I'm going to read from that second. The first one is one I wrote recently when I was at AWP in Seattle this year. It's called Last Night in Seattle. I mistake Axe body spray for Terre d'Hermes. The longest piece of driftwood will not fit in my suitcase. I think I see my cat on the bed, but it is just a pile of brochures from places I never went. Will the waterfront get its revival? Will the Space Needle show its rust? I flex my feet and feel the hills in my ankles. The rain remains noncommittal and thus demanding. I walk on the right side of the sidewalk, and oncoming pedestrians express inconvenience. Will the map shop across from the strip club sell to those who pretend roads aren't changing, or those who redraw them in pen? The tectonic plates below us continue to press and dive. I rub my hands together at the street corner to generate heat. The crosswalk light changes just in time. White for one direction and red for the other.
All right. The name of that poem was?
Last Night in Seattle.
Last Night in Seattle.
Yeah. I'm working, my thesis is on, inspired partially by a vintage Ames postcard, so interacting with the writers of those, but I'm trying to connect it to other places, you know, spatially that are relevant to me during this time of writing. So there are more Seattle poems. If anyone has a postcard from Seattle to Ames, let me know. I'd love that.
Well, that's just in time for our sesquicentennial celebration of Ames history.
Yeah.
All right, another?
Okay, this is from Prairie Gold. It's called I Know Where You Are. It's kind of a downer, so I'm sorry. I know where you are. It's summer, at a time of year when everyone else you know has forgotten about summer. You are examining an Egyptian butterfly with an oversized magnifying glass, no circle big enough for you. I know where you are. You are surrounded by exotic flowers you've identified with a field guide, reading a thick book recently published about our ancestors' genes, and people around you in turbans are enjoying the sun in a way that's practiced. I know where you are. In a photo, on a dusty hard drive, put there before hard drives got dusty. I know where you are. I thought I'd forget by now, but I know where you are. I thought I'd write to let you know evolution is still real and still just a theory to some people. Nobody you and I know. I know where you are. It is winter here, and there's no snow yet, and the same last year. In Minnesota, then Iowa, you never knew a winter without snow. Even that winter you went to Egypt, you came back. There was a bombing there the same day you arrived, but you came back. Iowa, your magnifying glass froze in your pocket, shatter-resistant lens, I still have it. I imagine your eyes on the other side. But I know where you are. Minnesota, the earth resistant like a real winter. In fact, we sent you off under quite the snow, a big circle bulging out from the tent, everyone who loved you breathing little clouds. We sang, you are my sunshine. It was dark and still snowing, hence the tent. You would have found it homey. I know where you are. Body heat, adding to entropy. I know where you are, the exact address you'll be, even on holidays. I imagine where you are, not your body, but where your mind got stuck. In the helicopter ripping between white states, me speeding on the asphalt under you, when did you stop listening? When did the words stop making sense? I imagine your mind mapping the damage to your body, listening for clues from the voices, gnawing on data over you, trying to sate themselves emotionally like a hunger for blood-clotting factors. In the road you threw up, the paramedics said, black beans, cheese, softened shreds of a beige plain. I told your mother, we always had black bean quesadillas in the dining hall. Mystery solved. I always added olives to mine. I know you. I think you threw up olives, too. I wonder if someone cleaned it up or if a raccoon ate it. You would have wanted it that way. They cut off your boxers, the ones I gave you for Christmas, red with butterflies, real enough. You could maybe identify them with your field guide. I know where you are, always, and finally, I can stop worrying about you, about slushy roads and dark crossways at the edge of winter. I know what you feel. We talked about it once, when you're filling the bath and you can't tell if it's so hot it's cold, or if it really is ice cold. You look at the faucet turned to H, but your body tells you, no, that's not true. It simply can't be what I am experiencing.
was a powerful ending.
Thanks.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks for inviting me. This is really fun.
Sure. Okay. I have some quotes here about poetry, and the poets are going to comment about them now. We are here live in the KHOI studio, our brand new bright green, apple green studio with a quilt on the wall, and celebrating Poetry Month, April, on this last day of April. We have the quote here from Leonard Cohen, speaking of mixing music and poetry. Leonard Cohen says that poetry is just the evidence of life. If your life is burning well, poetry is just the ash. And Javier was going to say something about that. Did that one resonate with you?
That really speaks to me in the sense of that, you know, the creation of all my poems really come from the ash of experiences that I lived. So for me, really, that's when I'm operating in my most dynamic, powerful voice, is when it's a real emotional event that you can kind of parallel with a burn, whether it's a good burn or a bad burn, but that so that the product is this ash, and that ash becomes the poem, essentially.
Well, that kind of brings up the issue of, you know, what do poets do every day, you know, besides smoke cigarettes, I guess. How do you create that burn if that's what's going to make your art, you know, brilliant? How do you find that?
I think you can do two things. You can read a lot, or you can live a lot. And I think both have value. So, but I think Jennifer could answer that question.
Well, I think Hav and I write from very different places. I think Hav writes directly from personal experience a lot more than I do. Even though a personal experience is the thing that drives me into a poem, it isn't what the poem is about. So I find poetry to be this, like, it is the jello of language. It's just this weird thing. We're like cartoonists, but we're using words. We can move so fast as poets. A fiction writer has to lay down several sentences before they can change. We can change what we're doing in the middle of a word. We can put up a hand and it turns into a flower. We could put down a foot and it turns into a railroad tie. So I like living in that very uncanny, gelatinous space of poetry, which comes out of just living my life every day and being in tune with the incongruities that are happening around me and the language that's around me. So maybe that's what the ash is paying attention. Maybe that's what the time is taken up with, which looks very much like you're doing nothing at all. But that's what poets are doing. We're paying attention. And that's why we make the big bucks.
Well, another one of these quotes is, to be a poet is a condition, not a profession.
I just did a reading at a college in California, and one of the students raised their hand and asked, how do you become a professional poet? And that's sort of like saying, how do you become a rich nun? It is not a thing that exists. You can become a teacher, you can become a writer, you can become a copywriter, but a poet, there's no such, we're all amateurs.
Well, how did you know when you were a poet, though?
I knew when I was published the first time in Best American Poetry. It's sort of go through doors that open. Have you ever heard that adage? So this is a door that opened to me. And I didn't have a lot of doors opening at the time, so I went through the one that opened.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm. You like the quote by Carl Sandburg, poetry is the journal of a sea animal living on land, wanting to fly in the air. That really connects with that whole gelatinous thing.
The strangeness of it. There used to be that. We had one in the bar I used to always go to. It was this little game. It was a 20 questions game. you would think of something, anything, Martha Washington, a coat hanger, whatever, and you'd press go on the machine, and it would ask animal, vegetable, or mineral. And eventually, this thing was really uncanny. It could get Martha Washington. It could guess a coat hanger. But the one thing it couldn't guess, poetry and poems. It's a slippery little thing. Slippery animal.
Do you have another slippery beast to share with us?
I do, but it might take me a while to find it.
Okay. Jim, how about you? Want to weigh in on the process of poetry?
On process of poetry? You know, I have about 1,000 processes for poetry because each poem is a different beast for me. I also write songs and I write plays and I write sermons and I write stories. What happens for me is I catch a little glimpse of something, and I don't know if I'm OCD or whatever. The metaphor that comes to mind is when hens see a spot of blood on another hen, and they have to peck. And they peck and they peck and they peck until they tear that hen open. And I know that's a grossly... We're in farm country. I guess people can handle the hen-pecked metaphor. But I see this little spot of a topic or a subject or a theme or a rhythm or a sound structure or an image or a whatever, and I have to peck. And so wherever that is in the poem, that's where I start. If it's the first line, that's where I start. And I say the first line over and over until I get a second line. If it's an image, that's where I start. And I free write around the image. If it's a sound, that's where I start. And I pace my living room and I yell until that sound turns into words. I grab on to whatever handle I'm given, and I find my way into the poem from there.
Well, you go through whatever door there is, right?
I suppose. Jennifer and I aren't all that different. She's better looking.
No, that's not true.
Or you're also, I also thought maybe you're picking your way out of a shell and into something bigger.
It's true. I'm a shell person. It doesn't sound like it, like in a radio studio, because I prepare myself to be social. But you run into me on the street, my head's down, my hands are in my pockets. I give you a hey, because I'm in a shell. Maybe you're onto something there. Poetry is one of the places I break out.
Well, I was also just following up on the sea animal living on land, waiting to fly. All right, Jennifer, are you ready with another poem?
I do. I found this one. This is from my second book. So if you hated the poems from the third book, wait till you hear the ones from the second book. This is called Short People. And I love reading right now to these listeners because I bet more people know who Randy Newman is than in the colleges that I've been reading at recently, where the students don't know who Randy Newman or Burt Reynolds is. So this is good.
By the way, Jennifer is tall.
I am.
And I'm short.
Yes.
So this better be good.
So when you visualize what we could look like, visualize the discrepancy in height, and it's so much funnier. This is called Short People. When Emperor Hirohito told the Japanese people it was time to surrender, he never used the word surrender. Instead, he talked about how everyone had done their best, tried so hard, and so forth. His speech was broadcast over loudspeakers hung outside on electrical poles. People had never heard Hirohito's voice before. They thought the emperor was God. He spoke in the highest level of formality, using words so antiquated, ordinary people couldn't understand a thing he was talking about. So imagine, suddenly, one day, a disembodied voice we think is God's starts talking to people in the streets in booming Shakespeare speak. What the hell's God saying? All the people ask. A man wearing big glasses translates. He's saying, he thinks we all did a really great job. The man pauses, furrows his brow. But I think he wants us to give up. This is what most of Randy Newman's songs are about.
Okay.
God. I don't know if that fell totally flat.
No.
Oh, good. Okay.
I'm speechless. I think that's
good.
What it is.
Good. Oh, good. Always the reaction I'm hoping for. Stunned speechlessness.
Okay. How much time do we have left here?
1 minute.
All right. Javier, did you have anything else?
I just want to say thank you. It's a real honor. It's an honor to be here with all these poets. They're all poets that I admire. This radio station is a station that I admire. And Ames, the town of Ames, Iowa, is a town that I love. So thank you. Thanks for having us on. Thanks for celebrating National Poetry Month.
It's the cruelest month.
It's the cruelest month.
April.
Mm-hmm. April. And it's, again, it's a real honor. Jim Kopic and I have been friends for a long time. Jennifer L. Knox and I have been friends forever.
Ever.
Claire K.
Not as friends.
Claire C. Claire C. and I have been friends forever. So it's really nice to be here. It's like being with family.
I heard that you are leaving our fair city, but it's encouraging that you plan to come back.
Yeah, yes, I will. I will.
Periodically for poetry readings.
Yeah.
Maybe
Monday,
even in
April
this space?
5th, 2015, the Great Hall.
Oh, my God. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Brad. All right. Well, we are at the end of the hour. For this week's Local Talk, I've been your host, Greta Anderson. Today's topic was the Ames Poetry Revival and poetry in general. The Ames Poetry Revival that I just mentioned above has a Facebook page so you can keep track of what's happening. We spoke with Jim Kopic, a longtime Ames resident, a longtime slammer. We also heard from poets Javier Cambajosos, who teaches at ISU, as well as being a full-time poet, also a father, I think,
yes.
Which takes some time. He's
but a superhero.
A poetry superhero who has a book, Barbarian at the Gate, and who will be having another book coming out.
Diamond Grove Slave Tree from Ice Cube Press. Next fall. And I gotta say, since you mentioned my kids, hello to Dominic, Brooklyn, and Carlos, and my beautiful wife Shelly, who's home taking care of all my kids right now, so I could be out here playing
yes.
around with you guys.
Thank you, Shelly. Xavier also has a website, xaviercavazos.weebly.com. We'll link to that on our website, khoyfm.org. We also heard several poems by Jennifer L. Knox. Jennifer has an amazing resume of publications and an amazing Andy Warhol-like website. Then that, too, will be linked. But for those who want to go to it now, it's pretty easy, just jenniferlknox.com. Claire Kreuzel is the poetry editor for Flyway, Journal of Writing and Environment, an online journal out of ISU. And Flyway's website is also pretty simple, flyway.org, so check that out. Thank you to our guest engineer, James Winters.
Greta.
Without whom we could not do this show. Special thanks also to Ursula Rudenberg, without whom the station wouldn't be possible. I just love that construction, without whom.
Oh, love.
And then the negative added on top of that. So, Joe Lynch, who really stretched his skills, as he's always doing, to build the studio we are occupying right now. Thanks to all the donors out there who believe in KHOI and the community we are building through the spoken word in its many forms. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their album The Ballad of Kate Shelley. This show and all our previous shows and contact information are available on our website, khoyfm.org. That's khoyfm.org. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.